Welcome, welcome, beloved Gladys, to another LNL on RN Summer. Later on, the story of the fabulously talented Weintraub Syncopators, a group of fine young musos who enjoyed a thriving international career until they were interned during World War II here in Australia. But first to one of Britain's finer novelists, Edward Morgan Forster, or E.M. His most famous novels have been turned into films, Room with a View, Howard's End, and most spectacularly, A Passage to India, despite his view that they would never make a successful transition to stage, let alone celluloid. He was an avid traveller throughout the British Empire, a sharp observer of Britain's class system, both at home and abroad, but any revelation about his inner life had to wait for posthumous publication. It wasn't until 1971 Maurice was finally published, and another unfinished work, Arctic Summer, didn't see the light until 2003. Award-winning writer Damon Galgut has written his own fictionalised account of the inner life of E.M. and the events which led to his masterpiece, A Passage to India. It too is called Arctic Summer. And Damon joins me from our London studio. And I asked him whether he agreed that Forster's unfinished work, had it been completed, may have trumped his other noted masterworks.
I'm not in agreement with that view, actually. I've heard it expressed quite a bit. But if you look at the surviving fragment, because that's all it is, a fragment, it seems to be covering territory he's already covered. You know, it's Englishman abroad in a kind of muddle. Forster himself didn't think very highly of the piece, and of course he abandoned it, which is the ultimate judgment any writer can pass on their own work.
This is what's known as a Dorothy Dixer in Australia. It's a soft question that's asked at question time in Parliament. What drew you to Forster?
A common interest in India, primarily. I've been going back and forth to India quite a bit over the last 14 years. Cumulatively, I guess, I've spent quite a few years of my life there. And that took me back to A Passage to India, which is a book I've loved ever since I first read it. And I became interested in Forster's life story. And then sort of reading about Forster, I realized that the story of the writing of A Passage to India was really quite epic in its way. It took him 11 years to write. He was stuck for 9 years trying to work out a way forward with the book. And quite a lot of history intervenes. I mean, the First World War, during which Forster was posted to Alexandria. And of course, he had to make two trips out to India, two quite long trips out there. The second one as the private secretary to a Maharaja. And that all of this was very, very rich, interesting historical material, and that nobody had actually dug into it except in a biographical way. So it seemed to me like a really rich novelistic opportunity. I mean, as a novelist, aside from, you know, my interest in India, I've been interested for a while in the idea of writing a book about what goes into the making of a novel, and you know, as opposed to a novel that just sort of falls easily out of its creator. This was a book that you know, Forster really struggled to write, and you know, the story of a struggle is always more interesting than the story of something that happens easily. So yeah, these different factors were.
I wouldn't have been surprised if you'd answered in terms of your sexuality, because of course you're proudly and defiantly gay, and he couldn't be openly, defiantly gay.
I guess I should have mentioned that too. It is another sort of common area. I don't know how defiant I feel. I suppose it depends on the day of the week. But Forster, yeah, I was very interested in Forster's struggle with himself, because it really was an area of his life in which, you know, he just could not kind of give expression to his personality. I think more than the consequences of the law, he was afraid of his mother. And I've been careful in the book, actually, to offset Forster against various other gay male characters who were living their lives in a much fuller, braver kind of way. Because, you know, it might be easy to create the impression that everybody was terrified and everybody was repressed. And in fact, I think Forster was far more frightened than most other people.
I wonder if you'd be kind enough to read a page And I would suggest you open your copy of the book at 138. He found himself behaving in ways that were potentially dangerous.
Sure. He found himself behaving in ways that were potentially dangerous without quite knowing what he was up to. On one or two occasions, he loitered in public lavatories, hoping for some offer to present itself. Open spaces, especially those in Hyde Park, excited him with possibility. But there was only ever a glance, an accidental collision, which left him turbulent with fantasies. To act out of lust, even without any tender accompanying feeling, would be less damaging, he felt, than these corrosive bursts of desire that went nowhere. He took himself to see Nijinsky dancing almost naked in Afternoon of a Fawn, and the utter abandonment of that human body alarmed and delighted him, like an enactment of everything which roiled invisibly inside. Afterwards, he longed to miss his train home and give himself up wholly to adventures in the foliage somewhere, though he wouldn't have known where to go.
You read that beautifully, and I wanted you to do so because I wanted people to hear the way you've approached it, your own prose style, which is very elegant but dead simple. You haven't sought to complicate your narrative.
I struggled to... Well, I had to wrestle with myself to decide what particular voice with which to approach this material. It would be wrong, I think, to tell Forster's story in a voice that didn't somehow evoke Forster. So, although I hope this voice is authentically my own, I've also had to allow myself a kind of fullness of tone that perhaps my other books haven't delved into. And a certain humor, a certain kind of wry humor, which is Fosterian, I hope, and a slight formality of language, not a complicated one, but a slightly more formal way of speaking that might have fitted the time he lived in.
Damon, before we hurl ourselves via your novel into his novels, I have long been a great admirer of the short stories. I find the concentration of myth and mysticism in some of the stories quite overwhelming, and stylistically at arm's length from what anyone else was doing.
Yeah, I mean, Forster himself, I think, quite often thought of his short stories as his primary form. And for some reason, he gave expression in the short stories to an interest in a sort of pagan past, you know, the Greeks primarily, and sometimes the Romans, that he didn't really get into with his novels. But it was his visits to Italy that first let loose a sort of his novelistic spirit, his creative spirit. And of course, the early novels, most of them, I think with the exception of Howard's End, are set in Italy. But before that, in his years at Cambridge when he was studying there, he came to think of the Greek Empire as his what he called his stronghold for sentiment. In his mind, it was a kind of reference point for, I suppose, a different and maybe nobler morality and a way of doing things.
Tell us briefly about his early life.
Well, it depends what you think of as his early life, because he died, in his 90s. He lived a very long life. But he was born in 1879, his father died when he was two, and he lived with his mother, I mean, for the rest of her life, and she lived to the age of 90, when Forster himself was 66. They moved around between a lot of suburban settings in England. He always felt very suffocated by the English suburbs and by the attendant bourgeois morality that went along with that. And I think that had a lot to do, actually, with why other countries like Egypt or Italy or India could make him feel freer and able to live out some of his, deeper inner life.
Well, as you say, he lives with mum in a home county society of deadly properness.
That's
and
right.
Only with her death does he breathe more easily.
That's correct. I think his mother overshadowed his life to a huge degree. There's a lot of circumstantial evidence. I mean, nothing absolutely definitive, but a lot of evidence that suggests Forster's father himself was gay. And although that's probably not something that Forster's mother would have consciously known. On some unconscious level, she probably took that on. And I believe it communicated through her to Forster himself. And I think there was a sort of unspoken contract between the two of them that he became her new husband after the father's death. I mean, not in any incestuous way. It was an entirely chaste marriage. But he felt obliged to attend to her in the way that a husband would look after a wife. And I think there were, part of the contract between them was that he would not let her down in the way that his father had. In other words, I think he felt forbidden to live his gay life, basically.
His mum was upset even by the affair between Leonard and Helen in Howard's End. She said she knew nobody who behaved like that.
Yeah, that's correct. It was a moment between them that caused Forster quite a lot of anguish. I think it was one of the few occasions he'd allowed himself to be just a little bit risque in terms of, you know, male-female relationships, which he always felt, incidentally, were an aspect of life he knew nothing about, despite the fact that, you know, he wrote incredibly well about them. What he wanted to be doing was writing about the relationships between men, but even when he, you know, he wrote about men and women, you know, as in the example you've just cited, he could upset his mother deeply if he crossed a moral line. So one can imagine how she might have reacted if she'd actually read, you know, his more erotic short stories or Maurice, for that matter.
So here's Forster, whose life was very much about the gulf between imagination on the one hand and expectations and reality on the other, and this yearning and unrequited love was to become his constant companion.
Yeah, although he had other companions. I mean, for me, the kind of center of my book, what really compelled me to write the story, is the connection between his desires, if you like, his intimate desires, and his creative life. There were two areas of his life he kept very, very secret. I mean, if you look at his journals and his letters, there's almost nothing about those two things. And it's pretty clear he fell in love with a young Indian man called Syed Ross Masood, whom he met first in 1906.
To whom he dedicates a passage to India.
That's correct. And I think for the very simple but overwhelming reason that Masood was the force behind the writing of the book. It's why Forster went out to India in the first place. Masood had already talked to him about, you know, writing an Indian novel, so he'd planted the idea. What played out between them, or rather what didn't, because I there was a very key moment between the two of them on that first visit to India, which is cryptically mentioned in Forster's diary, where it's plain to me that he tried to make some kind of move on Masood in the middle of the night, the night before he went to the caves, in fact, when he knew he wouldn't be seeing Masood again for the rest of his stay there, another 3 months, or indeed for many years afterwards. And he was rejected by Masood, that much is clear. And I think it was in that state of mind he went to the caves, and I believe it was in that state of mind that he conceived this episode of the attack, or non-attack,
yeah,
actually.
Yeah. So we have the stitched-up Englishman whose life consisted of taking tea with elderly ladies versus the open, flamboyant and mercurial Indian. It's an overwhelmingly potent image, isn't it, the visit to the caves?
Well, it is, although in his diary, it's sort of curiously offhand, and I've been to those caves to visit them, and I sort of they were unremarkable, and I mean even in A Passage to India, he describes them as ostensibly unremarkable, and yet, out of their very banality, there's something else underneath the surface, and you know the famous echo and the kind of vision of emptiness and nothingness, a spiritual vision that underpins it, are very much at the center of the novel.
I've got to ask you, Damon, did you try the famous echo when you were there?
Oh, yeah, certainly. I mean, most of the caves, in fact, are half-finished and the echo doesn't work very well, but there's one particular cave in which the echo is absolutely spectacular. I mean, the cave itself is not remarkable to look at, but the echo is very memorable.
Okay, so at the start of your book, Morgan meets a handsome young officer called Seawright on the ship to India, who unashamedly talks about his secret tastes and what Morgan might find in India. And Morgan finds this shocking.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, if you, again, Seawright was a real person that Morgan encountered on this voyage. But if you look at his diaries, there's almost nothing there except this very telling phrase, amazing conversation. And I had to kind of delve into Seawright's own past to find, you know, to fire up my imagination as to what that amazing conversation might have entailed. But Seawright, even by the standards of, you know, contemporary standards, is a very startling figure. He was very much out there. At the time that Forster met him, he'd had 40 lovers, but by the end of his life, he'd had about 400. And he documented all of these encounters in an epic poem that he was writing as he went along, as well as keeping a tally at the back of a notebook of, you know, how many encounters, all kinds of other vital statistics I won't go into on live radio, but it's all very, very startling and probably the polar opposite of what somebody like Forster represented. I mean, you couldn't get more removed.
Going back to Morgan and Massoud, he must have been somewhat confused because Massoud would write letters to him saying, centuries may pass, years may turn into 2,000 centuries, and you never hear from me. And you are not to think that the great affection, the real love, and the sincerest admiration that I feel for you has in any way diminished. That's a beautiful love letter.
They're all like that. It's quite unnerving actually to read through Massoud's letters to Forster, because they read like very, very romantic love letters. And, you know, a number of people sort of in frustration, I suppose, with Forster for being in love for so many years with an obviously straight man, you know, who ask, why did he not just leave? Why did he not break this off? I mean, I think that language has a lot to do with it. I mean, as a gay man in love with somebody who writes to you in those terms and tells you they want to go away with you to the other side of the world and to be alone with you forever and that you're the only person who understands them. I mean, these are cues that are very hard to resist, and, you know, Forster did not resist them.
Ellen Nell on RN Summer. My guest is Damon Galgut, and he's speaking about the novelist Edward Morgan Forster. Yes, E.M. Now, here's, let's find another way into this. Passage to India, so long in the making, over 10 years and two trips to India. Why? Why such a long gestation?
Well, it's clear that Forster got stuck. It seems he got stuck about 70 pages in. I believe, and so does Oliver Stalybras, who was the person who first edited and collated the original manuscripts of A Passage to India, that the point at which Forster got stuck was deeper into the book, on the caves episode specifically. Stalybras believes it's like that because the existing original drafts of that episode look like fair copies. In other words, Forster had tried to write that scene in the caves. It had not worked out, and when he picked up the book again and tried to move forward, he'd copied out what he'd done before and thrown the original work away, which is something I do as a writer, and I'm sure other writers would relate to that. Why the caves episode got him stuck? I believe, again, it's got to do with the fact that episode is a kind of fantasy that's connected to Massoud. I think in Forster's original conception, it was his fantasy of being loved, touched in a loving way by Massoud that turned itself inside out and became a fantasy of attack and assault. But in his early drafts, he's written it as an actual attack. I mean, in other words, Dr. Aziz, who's accused of the attack, actually does carry it out. It's very unconvincing as a piece of writing, and Forster himself felt it. He was never very good at writing about physical violence. And so I think he really wrestled with this issue, how to make this attack into something more than simply an attack. And then by a brilliant stroke, he realized that it was a fantasy. I think in himself, he realized that what had been the genesis of the scene was a fantasy.
It's interesting, and there's another parallel with Joan Lindsay. She decides not to give answers. She decides to make Miranda's misadventures at Hanging Rock utterly enigmatic and mysterious. And by saying less, of course, you force the reader to imagine more.
Well, indeed. And I mean, I think in the case of A Passage to India, it's an especially brilliant stroke because it's if he had simply written it as an attack and then the court scene had followed, it would be nothing really more than a kind of semi-political drama. But by making it an imagined attack, he actually turns it into something else. He gives it a huge kind of spiritual dimension. And I mean, you've been talking about Picnic at Hanging Rock. That is a very, people are chilled and disturbed by something they cannot explain. And that same quality kind of presides over both stories, really. And in Forster's case, of course, I mean, I grew up with this in South Africa, this continual obsessive fear of the rape, sexual attack on white women by black men. And it was clearly a prevalent fear in India at the time. And looking back on it, it's very obviously a kind of guilt fantasy. Because,
well, it's very much a part of what Kutsaya writes about South Africa too, isn't it? It's, the whole issue of rape.
Yeah, I mean, rape on one hand is a brutal reality in South Africa. I mean, we have quite shockingly high rape figures, but this particular, most of those figures do not relate to the rape of white women by black men. I mean, that particular fear is about what white people were doing to black people in South Africa. It's a kind of guilt thing, and it gets projected outward in this fear of what might happen in the form of revenge. And I think the same thing is true was true under the Raj in India.
And meanwhile, of course, was absolutely true in the southern states, the slave states of America.
That's right. Yeah, that's another place you see exactly that same fear fantasy cropping up, basically.
Yeah. Look, what was the attitude to homosexuality within the Raj? And I ask about both the British and the Indians.
Well, you know what? I think it's been widely reported now that homosexuality, which was briefly made legal in India, has now been made illegal again. And it's been made illegal under what were British colonial laws under the Raj. I mean, I think it's called something like Acts Against the Order of Nature, put on a par with bestiality, basically. So the official British attitude was not friendly, to say the least. But it's pretty clear if you read Forster's diaries and, you know, his doings at the palace, and then the doings of somebody who followed Forster into a similar situation in one of the princely states, who was J.R. Ackerley. His marvelous book, Hindu Holiday, documents quite a lot of homosexual activity. It's my strong impression that though it was officially frowned upon, to say the least, I mean, unofficially, it was prevalent and going on everywhere. And on my visits to India, I'm continually startled by the way young men, boys and young men, relate to each other there. You see no physical contact between the sexes. Men and women keep, even married men and women, keep themselves very much apart, you know, not even holding hands in the street. But it's perfectly normal for young guys to walk around holding hands or draped over each other, stroking each other in public.
But that's also true almost throughout the Islamic world. When I used to go to Cairo, to Egypt in happier times, it was absolutely customary to see young men walking hand in hand.
Yeah, but very few of these people would think of themselves as gay. They'd be horrified if it was suggested. But it would be surprising if that kind of homoerotic closeness didn't spill over into some activity some of the time. But I think they'd regard it as letting off steam as opposed to taking on an identity.
Damon, what was Forster's religious beliefs? What were they?
Well, he was raised very much in a kind of Church of England atmosphere. But when he went to Cambridge, he decided that he thought Christianity was an absurdity, and he wanted, you know, nothing more really to do with it. So he shed his Christian beliefs. But I think his time in India definitely stirred up a kind of inclination towards the mystical. He was very, very interested in Hinduism.
Well, in temples, mosques, roadside shrines. He was very moved by all of this, wasn't he?
Well, yeah, he was very stirred by it. I mean, you can't visit India even now without being struck by how much a part of daily life religion is. I mean, it's interwoven into anything. I mean, no politician will make a decision without getting an astrological reading, for example. But I mean, everybody, you know, pays a visit to their shrine or to their mosque on a daily basis and offers their prayers and so on. So I think that sort of fervor struck Forster. But he was also very interested in the rituals of Hinduism and what they meant. I think they remain to some extent opaque to him, but he did try to comprehend and to write about them for other Englishmen at home.
Let me quote you. Every day served up a scene, a conversation, that was like two sharp edges grinding against each other. It was the meeting of the two world views, one way of life imposed upon another, which brought out the worst in both. Was he politicized by his experiences?
I guess to a large extent he was, although Forster would not have thought of himself as a political person, and I think it was always a little bit of an effort for him to think in those terms. But there's no doubt that spending a lot of time with people like Massoud and Massoud's circle of friends, he would have been listening to a great deal of anti-British rhetoric. I mean, even back in Oxford, where Massoud was studying, there was a lot of talk about the end of the Raj and, you know, Indian freedom from the British and so on. So Forster was taking that on all the time. But again, I think the novelist in him would translate that sort of political talk into something more human, into the form of, you know, particular characters expressing particular sentiments, which was his great gift. And it's why A Passage to India doesn't read like a political novel. It reads like a human drama.
There is a point when it reads like a legal novel, which is not surprising. You know, the courtroom scenes are so powerful. And all his friends were barristers. You know, Massoud and all his mates were barristers. Forster's English friends mostly work for the Indian Civil Services magistrates. But as you point out, or have it pointed out by Forster, even the finest minds from the highest classes regarded each other with contempt.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, in Forster's travels in India, he spent a fair bit of time in courtrooms. I mean, you see it again in the diaries and the letters, looking at quite arbitrary cases. I mean, nothing as startling as Adela Quested's alleged assault case, but just small cases where British justice was being administered. And I think, you know, in that situation, he couldn't help but see it from the Indian point of view as well as the British. I mean, he had friends like Malcolm Darling, who worked as a magistrate too, who were trying to do their best out there to be genuinely fair and to settle things in a way that was equitable. So he was in tune with that too. But he couldn't help hearing a different narrative from the British people he was hanging out with, from the one that you know he was hearing when he was with the Indians. So he was getting two stories, and there was no way to reconcile those two.
I confess that despite my atheism and materialism, that I was seduced and almost persuaded by Forster's short stories, particularly the ones which evoke the Greek and the Roman. You write, "The supernatural was a form of thinking that had been worn away in England, lingering mostly in its literature. So what struck Morgan most forcefully was how casually it took place, almost underfoot, an accepted part of everyday life." And Morgan once wrote, and I quote, "I am a holy man minus the holiness." I like that.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think there's an incident which he recounts in his diary, and then he lifts it wholesale and puts it into A Passage to India when he's the private secretary to the Maharaja of Devas. And the Maharaja has some visitors one day who talk about an animal running into the road and hitting their car as opposed to their car hitting it. And the Maharaja is half asleep, suddenly wakes up and says, "Was it at such and such a point on the road?" And they say, "Yes." And did the animal look a bit like a buffalo and a bit like a lion? And they said, "Yes, yes. How did you know that?" And he said, "Well, it's very unfortunate. That's a place where I once ran a man over in my car. And ever since that time, he's been coming back to haunt me in exactly this form at this place." And Forster was very startled by that, because it was said factually as if this was an expected part of everyday life. And I think he found this in India all over the place that what we might be skeptical about in a, you know, our context as something superstitious, magical, unrealistic, was and still is, in fact, accepted as very much a part of everyday life there. It happens.
Yeah. I'm suddenly feeling compelled to ask you about your own spiritual views.
You laugh. Well, I do because I probably share your outlook. I'm cynical and atheistic, really. Despite my numerous visits to India, I've remained impervious to religion. So yeah, not even Forster has budged me, I'm afraid. But I do sort of resonate with the vibrations of the kind of pagan things that he talks about. But I think it's more on a cellular level. I mean, it's hard to resist drums and cymbals and smoke and incense. It doesn't necessarily mean you believe in what's behind them.
No, but it is fun, though, isn't it? Okay, now let's go back to England and the attitude to homosexuality. Behind us, there's the vicissitudes of poor old Oscar Wilde. Ahead, the horror story of Alan Turing. The great professional embarrassments by John Gielgud, but you insist that Morgan was more fearful than he needed to be, that there were quite a few gay people who were out at the time.
Well, there were. I mean, I've given the example of Seawright on the ship with his 40 lovers, but Forster encountered, for example, Edward Carpenter was an Englishman from the same class as Forster, who was living quite openly with his younger working-class lover, George Merrill. And not only writing about gay love, which he called homogenic love, but, you know, taking on a multitude of other causes like women's rights, anti-vivisection, vegetarianism. I mean, he was a hippie way before his time. And people knew. I mean, it was not really up for debate that Carpenter was living a gay life, and yet nobody sort of took action against him. Even Wilde, if he had not kind of tried to press the point in a legal sense, may have got away with what he was up to.
Yeah, I'm sure that's right. Okay, we've only got minutes left, so let's move on to another aspect of the life. When the Great War begins in 1914, Morgan wasn't a conscientious objector, but knew he did not want to fight. So what happens?
Well, he wanted to take part in some way. He didn't feel that he could just sort of hold back, and he found a good outlet for himself in working for the Red Cross as a searcher in Alexandria. Searching meant interviewing wounded men in the hospitals and trying to find out what had happened to other people in their companies, so that reports could be sent back to England and these people could be traced or at least listed as dead and their families informed and so on. But of course, you know, there were constant attempts to kind of round up even the Red Cross workers into the military. And it's one of the few points on which Forster really felt very, very strongly that he would not participate. He said the idea of killing another human being was the worst thing that he could contemplate, and he really would not be budged on that.
It's in Alexandria where he has a relationship with a young bus conductor, Mohammed Al-Adri, and at the age of 38 is a virgin no more. Did he write rapturously about losing his virginity?
No, in fact, he lost his virginity prior to meeting Mohammed. People think it's on the beach with the soldier, although he was never very explicit about it. He did document, not intended for publication, but he did document his relationship with Mohammed Al-Adl in a letter that he wrote after Mohammed's death, which has been published in only one edition of Forster's Egyptian writings. And it's an incredibly moving document. It's truly heartbreaking. But he was writing it to his friend as a kind of memorial to his friend. And I think he might be very uncomfortable knowing I was talking about it right now.
You know, it fascinates me to learn, because I didn't know this, that when he was in Alexandria, he becomes friends with that most famous poet, Kafafi, who doesn't share openly his own homosexuality with Morgan, or let alone even tell him about the best places, to find some rough trade. But they read poetry together.
Yes, that did in fact happen. I mean, I had to create it as a set piece, but Cavafy read his poems to Forster, and Forster was hugely instrumental in bringing Cavafy's poems to the attention of the West, basically. He worked tirelessly on his behalf, without thanks.
The opening pages of your book has a quote by Forster, made in 1953 to Furbank. Orgies are so important, and they're the things one knows nothing about.
Yeah, well, that kind of sums up his life, doesn't it? Which I've tried to sort of sum up even further by appropriating his title of Arctic Summer. I just think it's such a great image for Forster's condition. On the one hand, it's frozen and empty and there's nothing happening. And on the other hand, it's summertime, you know, there's light shining in, because Forster was not an unhappy man.
Well, you've done him proud, and it's a beautifully written book, Damon, and I thank you very much for your time. Damon Gougart, the author of Arctic Summer, published by Atlantic Books. Coming up, the sad story about the fate of the Weintraub syncopators. But first, a sample of their sound.